Welcome back to the program. Most of us remember the story of Icarus and what happened when Icarus used his waxen wings to take off, but was warned not to go too far and not to go too close to the sun. My guest, Peter Beinhart, in his new book, The Icarus Syndrome, uses this analogy to look at the success and failures of American foreign policy, the success and the hubris that has grown from that success, and our national tendency to fly too close to that proverbial sun. Peter Beinhart has also written a powerful article that appeared in the June 10th issue of the New York Review of Books, entitled The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment, in which he looks at the tenuous relationship between young American Jews and the State of Israel. Peter Beinhart is a former editor of The New Republic. He's currently senior political writer for The Daily Beast and an associate professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York. It is my pleasure to have Peter Beinhart on this program to talk about his new book, The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris. Peter Beinhart, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. One of the things that you talk about, and it reminds me sort of the Bill Clinton campaign back in 1992, it's the economy, stupid, that much of our success in terms of American foreign policy, much of our strength, comes from the fact that it was a stronger economy that allowed us to build up a strong military and not a strong military that gave us a stronger economy and a stronger nation.
Yes, I think this is really particularly the essential insight today. I think the drama that's likely to play out over the Obama administration is a drama of strategic retrenchment. America's going to have to leave Iraq. I think we're going to have to leave Afghanistan as well. And there will be a tendency to associate that with national weakness and decline. I think the critical thing to understand is that military interventions that are not sustained by American power are not a source of strength, they are a source of weakness. And that in fact to regain American strength economically, we have to retrench to some degree militarily in order to rebuild the foundation of American economic power.
One of the things that's so fascinating is that as you talk about the history of this, going back to World War I, it seems that this idea of American power coming from America's economic strength has always been true, and yet it seems to be, or that it should be, more true, particularly in this global economy that we have today.
I think the wiser American presidents have recognized that to define America's military ambitions in such a way that threatened the nation's economy was to put the cart before the horse. That essentially the goal of foreign policy is to secure a successful society at home. And if you define America's ambitions as so great that they start to undermine that, then you defeat the purpose. It's interesting that the Obama administration in recent months has been quoting Dwight Eisenhower a lot. Because Eisenhower was the president who famously was accused of being more afraid of a deficit than of communism. Eisenhower was extremely concerned. Remember, as people who had seen up close the fragility of the American economy during the Depression, were very concerned not to let the Cold War, the struggle against Soviet communism, become a crusade that would bankrupt the United States. And I think, in a way, Obama is wrestling with finding a way to fight the so-called war on terror within those same constraints.
There's also the degree, and you write a lot about this in the Icarus Syndrome, the degree to which Reagan understood this, that Reagan understood that the end objective was success at home as much as anything else, and that he didn't need necessarily to prove toughness if, in fact, he was achieving that success in other ways.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with lots of Reagan's policies as a liberal, but I think there's a great, great need to remember the reality of the Reagan administration as opposed to the myth that has been built up amongst conservatives about the Reagan administration. Ronald Reagan, although he spent a huge amount on the military, and although he did support anti-communist groups like the Contras and the Afghan Mujahideen, was extremely, extremely cautious about direct American military intervention. He was deeply constrained by the legacy of Vietnam and highly, highly attuned to the fact that the American people were not willing to engage in long military, direct military intervention. In his last year in office in 1988, several of his aides pushed him to invade Panama. And Reagan essentially said, "Are you crazy? Invading Panama is one of the most frightening things I could ever contemplate. You know, we look back at now at Panama as kind of little easy war, but that wasn't the way Reagan saw it at all. I think it's really, really important to try to recapture the sense of caution about American direct military intervention that existed even for a hawk like Ronald Reagan, so we can see how far we have moved from that.
To what extent has the Vietnam experience shaped so much of our post-Vietnam foreign policy?
Well, it shaped American foreign policy tremendously for about 15 years, up until, I would say, the Gulf War. Panama and then the Gulf War and then Bosnia in 1995 were the kind of tipping points in which America began to move beyond the Vietnam syndrome. And to some degree, that was healthy. There was a tendency to see Vietnam in every military conflict, and therefore not to see the possibilities that, in fact, the Panama and the Gulf and Bosnia were more manageable wars. But I think by the time we got to the Iraq War, the Vietnam syndrome had been so repudiated, the very notion that Vietnam could be invoked at all had become so passé, that we lost our ability to learn anything from that war. And I think the deep wisdom of what people learned from Vietnam was the danger of putting American power in opposition to third world nationalism, the danger of putting America in a position in which it would look to people on the ground, even if it didn't look to us, like we had essentially supplanted the European powers in a colonial effort.
And that was particularly true, as you talk about, with Lyndon Johnson, who saw Vietnam not only as a situation where he needed to be tough, but was informed by what had happened in 1938.
Yes. You know, part of the theme of the book is the way in which people are very influenced by events that happened earlier on in their lives and tend to draw analogies between those incidents and what happens later on, and the way in which we fall prey to bad analogizing. And I think one of the best examples of that is the way in which Johnson and the whole generation of the best and the brightest in the 1960s, who had been so deeply influenced by the lessons of World War II, the lesson that there are evil people in the world and they need to be resisted early on by force, took that lesson and overlearned it so that by the 1960s they were essentially looking for Hitlers in obscure corners of the Third World and creating a kind of apocalyptic sense of what would happen if, for instance, Vietnam was reunified as a communist nation, not being able to see that America's own strength, massively increased strength, had led them to have essentially a massively increased sense of fear, so that they saw a reunified communist Vietnam as the equivalent of, say, Hitler taking France.
One of the things you talk about is how we had, over a period of time, and Vietnam being kind of the penultimate example, twisted around the notion of containment, which had been so successful in the post-war period, really up until Vietnam.
Yeah. Again, I think this is one of the metaphor in the book is about Icarus, whose father, Daedalus, builds wings that are extraordinarily effective in accomplishing a certain task, getting them off the island of Crete, but wings that have limits, that are fallible, finite human creations. And I think the story of containment is the Icarus story. George Kennan and others build these remarkable wings, this policy of containment that is very effective at rebuilding Western Europe and Japan in the late 1940s and essentially halting the spread of Soviet communism without war. But by the 1960s, the best and the brightest generation have turned this limited, non-military, regional doctrine of containment into a global doctrine in which the U.S. must stop every communist movement from taking power anywhere in the world, virtually. And in that way, they essentially fly the wings of containment into the sun.
What did we learn, then, from the idea that the Cold War was fought and, in fact, turned out to be successful not from the barrel of a gun?
This is what's so important. It's very interesting that you find among some neoconservatives today the reference to the Cold War as World War III, which was a trope that you tend to find on the right, because the whole essence of the Cold War was that it was not World War III. The Cold War was an oxymoron, a war that did not turn hot at least not where it mattered most, on the battlefields of Central Europe. It was essentially an ideological and economic conflict, a bet by the Soviets that that American capitalism would fall prey to repeated cycles of depression, and that that would essentially turn people towards the left, a bet by the leaders of the United States and of Western Europe that we could stabilize and humanize capitalism so that, in fact, it could be dynamic without falling prey to these cycles of boom and bust. What's happened is, since the Cold War, particularly on the right, in the wake of America's military victories in the 1990s, there was a tendency to reimagine the Cold War as a military victory. And I think that set the intellectual foundation in many ways for the war in Iraq, the idea that the war in Iraq would usher in a kind of Middle Eastern 1989, a liberation throughout the Middle East, with not recognizing the fundamental difference, which was that 1989 did not come about because of military force. It came about because of peaceful diplomacy.
And this really harkens back to what you write about with respect to World War One, this notion that this Wilsonian notion that we could kind of replicate the American experience around the world.
Yes, I really think that it's a real tragedy of our foreign policy discussion that Americans are not more familiar with Woodrow Wilson and the debates that he set off. Because if you understand those debates, I think it helps to illuminate so much of the tendency of the debates that we have today, particularly because Wilson, these debates took place before the Cold War. So you can understand how America thought, American presidents thought, before the struggle against communism. Wilson's vision, which was a dramatically inspiring vision, was essentially a vision of a world in which nations would interact with one another in the way that individual Americans interacted with one another. So that just as conflicts in the United States were not resolved at the point of a gun, but by elections and court decisions and independent commissions, that the decisions between nations could also be determined through international bodies like the League of Nations, in which all countries would agree to a common set of principles and then enforce them against those nations that violated them. The fundamental mistake of this very powerful notion was not to recognize that international politics is anarchic. There is no sovereign like the United States government that can enforce its decisions. And therefore, tragically, in international politics, the barrel of a gun, naked power, will always be more central to the way that politics operates. And it was Wilson's inability to recognize this that I think blinded him to the need for America to join a balance of power alliance, the thing that he hated the most, against German power.
And how have neocons extended this idea to their view of the world today? Because it does seem an extension of that notion.
Well, Wilson, neoconservatives have essentially read Wilson with one eye closed. They have taken Wilson's passion for the spread of democracy, but what they have lost is Wilson's belief in international law and international community. So that the notion that you would try to promote democracy is part of Wilson's legacy, but very, very centrally, the other part of Wilson's legacy is the notion of a regulated international system of rules that would bind all countries, including the United States. You know, these ideas of international law and of international institutions, first the League of Nations, then the United Nations, were very centrally American creations. And neoconservatives denigrate that part of Wilsonianism, even as they uphold the idea that America should spread democracy.
Mm-hmm. One wonders how, speculation though it may be, one wonders, you know, what Reagan's view, this radical optimistic view might be, of the situation in the Middle East today and how to deal with the terrorist threat today?
It's Reagan was very much an optimist in that way, very much a very unconservative man in his thinking. You know, conservatism has tended to be epitomized by the belief that human beings in their hearts are really no better than society out there in the world. This was fundamentally what distinguished conservatives from, say, the devotees of the social gospel in Christianity. Reagan was a very strange conservative because although he wanted lower taxes and a stronger military and to end abortion, the right to abortion, he had this very optimistic view of human nature. So I think Reagan would have perhaps been an optimist about the possibilities of Middle Eastern democracy. But the question is, what would he have been willing to do at the point of a gun to promote it? And I think there it's instructive to look at what Reagan did in Lebanon in 1983. It's about, you know, conservatives, one of the few criticisms that conservatives will level at Reagan is that after the Hezbollah bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in 1983, Reagan quickly withdrew the U.S. troops. He had no stomach for a long, prolonged ground war, essentially, in Lebanon. And while today's conservatives and neoconservatives criticize Reagan for running in the face of terror, Reagan's final words in the Oval Office were, "I should never have sent those troops to Beirut in the first place," which I think gives you a sense of Reagan's deep caution about American military intervention in the Middle East.
One of the things that has driven this, and particularly as we look at Bush and what's gone on with respect to Iraq, is this kind of perception of threat, this exaggerated sense of threat and terror coming out of the Middle East. And the irony is, as you write about this, that threat is relatively small compared to the threat that we experienced with nuclear missiles pointed at us during the Cold War.
Yes, I've come to believe, frankly, more than I did in the aftermath of 9/11, that the terrorist threat has been exaggerated. Now, though, you know, you kind of tremble uttering those words because we never know what could happen tomorrow in terms of what al-Qaeda could do. But it seems to me we have the responsibility to try to integrate what we've learned in the almost 10 years since 9/11 now into our discussion of the terrorist threat, which in many ways remains stuck in September 12, 2001, when so many people expected that we would suffer future 9/11s or even 9/11s plus with weapons of mass destruction. We have not, and in fact they haven't occurred anywhere in the world on the scale of 9/11. And I think that suggests, first of all, that the obvious point that al-Qaeda can't operate in the way it did before 9/11 because it's under so much pressure from us and other governments. And secondly, that we exaggerated the political appeal of this ideology, that Reagan, Bush was always comparing jihadist terrorism to communism and fascism, but what made communism and fascism powerful ideological foes was the fact that many people believed, particularly when the West was in depression, that communism and fascism represented a better model of a prosperous, dynamic, modern society. Very few people in the Middle East believe that about Taliban, Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. They may cheer occasionally when al-Qaeda attacks Israel or the United States or Arab governments they don't like. But this is a very weak ideology we are fighting, and one I think that has very little capacity to take over governments in the Muslim world. And I think it's that more sober assessment of the threat that can prevent us from overreacting in some of the ways we have since 9/11.
How then is this Icarus syndrome that you talk about, this sense of success, how is it going to be shaped and altered by the events taking place now in Iraq and Afghanistan?
I think the struggle for Barack Obama is that he's taking office in the wake of what I would call the collapse of a hubris bubble. You know, just as the stock market bubble popped, people realized that their belief that the stock market would go up and up and up has been shown to be tragically wrong. This belief that American power and America's military footprint would grow and grow and grow has also now been shattered. We are a little bit like the homeowner who believes that his house is worth $1 million and has found that it's only worth $500,000. But nobody likes the real estate agent who comes along and tells them that the house is only worth half as much as they thought it was. And that's where I think things get treacherous for Barack Obama. He essentially has to try to explain to Americans that we can't sustain these military interventions and that rebuilding our strength will require bringing them to an end, even though that end will be messy, unhappy, and in some ways even humiliating. You know, America's loss in Vietnam was agonizing, and the politics of it were brutal. But if one steps back and looks at what's happened in Asia more broadly, one sees the wisdom of putting aside the false dream that we could defeat Vietnamese communism and, in fact, indeed, Vietnamese nationalism, and putting it aside for better, more realistic dreams about what America could accomplish in the world. And that, it seems to me, is part of the drama of the Obama administration, putting aside the false, unrealizable dreams that we have set ourselves, that we are now trying to pursue in Afghanistan in particular, and pursuing more realistic dreams about the rebuilding of American economic power so that we can compete in a world in which we face many, many new economic competitors.
Moving to your New York Review of Books story, is this part of the problem or a similar kind of problem in Israel today in that there is this sense of historical reliance on military force to make the country more secure, a situation that may not be a viable notion today?
I think there is. I think Israel has become so used to its dominant military power in the region that, to some degree, like the United States on the eve of the Iraq War, it became too easy for Israel to turn to military solutions rather than trying to be as diplomatically and politically creative and innovative as it might have been. And I think just as the United States has learned that its enemies have been able to adapt to American military power, bogging the U.S. down in insurgency campaigns rather than fighting the U.S. conventionally, and building up and trying to develop nuclear weapons as a way of deterring America's massive conventional strength. I think you've seen that Israel's enemies, be they Hezbollah or Hamas or Iran, have learned those same lessons. And I think it's imperative for Israelis, although it's a very difficult process, to also try to think about how they can use the other tools of their power, diplomacy, and also to try to rebuild Israel's deeply, deeply damaged soft power. The idea that the legitimacy of Israel, which has suffered so much, it seems to me, in recent years in the eyes of the world.
What damage was done to the extent that during 8 years of the Bush administration, essentially Israel had a blank check from the United States?
I think the Bush administration is really the very important example to show to those people who believe that we best serve Israel and our love for Israel, those of us who consider ourselves Zionists, by essentially allowing the Israeli government to do whatever they want, funded in part by the United States, when in fact I think what the Bush administration did was enabled Israel to take actions that were not in its own best traditions and that have been to some degree harmful to its own security. Israel, the settlement process in particular, has become as the authors of one book about the settlements describe it, a body that now has no head, that goes forward involuntarily. Israel is on automatic pilot vis-a-vis the settlement process, pushed forward by parts of the Israeli bureaucracy that are devoted to this project. And essentially, Israel needs to be shaken out of that complacency to recognize the grave threat to its own existence as a democratic Jewish state that the settlement process represents. And it seems to me America, as Israel's best friend in the world, a country in which Zionism really does run deep, not only amongst Jews but amongst American Christians, is best positioned to say to Israel, look in the mirror, look at what's happening here, and look at the dangerous future that you are courting. I think, tragically, Israeli politicians have lost the capacity to do that themselves and need our help in that process.
But in fact, what's happening is, while there's certainly some criticism within Israel of these policies, criticism in the U.S. has been pretty much shut off, and that gets to the point that you talk about in the New York Review of Books articles about young people in this country and young liberal Zionists and their intimidation from criticism.
Well, I don't know if I would use the word intimidation. I would put it slightly differently. There is a lot of criticism that takes place amongst American Jews of Israel. The problem is that the American Jewish communal leadership, by and large, takes the position that there should be no public criticism. And therefore, I think what you find is, for young American Jews who are searching for their own Zionist identity, who have come up, who have grown up in the wake of these Israeli policies that are very troubling to them as liberals. These American Jews, more frankly than American Christians in general, do really essentially identify with liberal political values. They've been given no space within the organized American Jewish community for a critical Zionism, a Zionism of love for Israel, awe for what Israel has accomplished, and deep concern about the way in which Israeli policies may undermine those accomplishments. And that, it seems to me, is where younger American Jews are being, to some degree, betrayed by their elders. Because, by not being given a space for a critical Zionism, I fear they're being essentially pushed towards non-Zionism or even anti-Zionism.
And concurrent with this, you talk about, is a demographic shift that's taking place in American Jewry.
Yes, there is a fundamental demographic shift that's taking place in American Jewry. In some ways, it parallels the shift within Israel, in which Orthodox Jews are becoming a larger and larger percentage of the American population. Now, in many ways, the vibrancy of Orthodox American Jewry, its commitment to Jewish learning, is something to be inspired by. And I think there's an enormous amount that non-Orthodox Jews have to learn from Orthodox, from the Orthodox Jewish community in the United States, which happens to be the community in which my own family has made our lives. But the danger to me is that Orthodox Jewish Zionism very often lacks the liberal influences and principles that I think are so critical to supporting Israel as a liberal democracy. There is, I think, sadly, a tendency towards indifference sometimes towards Palestinian suffering and Palestinian dignity. You know, the fact that at the 2002 pro-Israel march on Washington, which was dominated really by Orthodox Jews, that Paul Wolfowitz could be booed when he talked about the need to recognize Palestinian suffering as well. It seems to me that Orthodox Jews should have used that moment as an opportunity to look deeply in the mirror and say, where have we gone wrong in teaching our children about the ethical component of Jewish law and Jewish tradition, the universalistic component, the quality of Rachmanis, of compassion for others. You know, it says in the Talmud that it is better to throw oneself alive into a burning furnace than to publicly humiliate a fellow human being. And I think it's that element that is not being inculcated in the American Orthodox Jewish community.
And what role, if any, should American foreign policy and the Obama administration at this point play in trying to foster this with respect to the Jewish community in Israel?
The Obama administration, I think, found itself very constrained by a Congress that doesn't want it to exercise pressure on Israel, and by Jewish organizations that also try to influence the Obama administration not to put pressure on the Israeli government. But I think, tragically, we have an Israeli government today that is only willing to make even the most minimal concessions, is only willing that were it left to its own devices, would steadily and increasingly foreclose the possibility of a two-state solution, not to mention potentially demonizing the Arabs who live within 1967 Israel. And I think the Obama administration has to have the courage to recognize that and the self-confidence to believe that what it is doing is in the best interests not only of the United States, but of Israel when it confronts the Netanyahu government, and indeed that it in fact is pursuing a policy that, if not supported by many of the American Jewish organizations, is very much in keeping with the principles of most American Jews. It's difficult for the people in the Obama administration to have that self-confidence given the political pressure they're under, but I hope that they do.
Peter Beinart, the book is The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris. Peter, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.